Not many voters showed up yesterday, but the results are in. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We're going to look at the congressional race in Broward and Palm Beach counties, the one to replace the late Alcee Hastings. Then we'll go to Miami Beach and look at the fight over last call. Plus, Hialeah has a new mayor and a couple new faces show up in Miami's commission. Also, the group representing Miami's high school basketball referees wants to self-govern. If they can't, could Miami schools miss out on a basketball season? And finally, there's a new exhibit in Key West that looks at the city before it became a tourist hub. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, the election results are mostly in. It was a small turnout. That's typical for elections in off years that don't get paired with a gubernatorial or presidential race. But let's take a look at the results from last night. And we're going to start with a congressional election to replace the late Alcee Hastings that was happening in Broward and Palm Beach counties. And I want to turn now to WLRN reporters Danny Rivero and Katie Switalski-Munoz. Danny, tell us about this district. I mean, what areas covered and who are the residents?
Right, so this district covers broad areas of Palm Beach County and Broward County. It goes all the way from Miramar up to Lake Okeechobee and the traditional agricultural areas there. Back east in Palm Beach County to the north. So it's a very big county, and basically it comprises most of the majority black areas of both those counties. And there's a lot of people there. There's a lot of poverty. It's actually one of the poorest congressional districts in the country. And they were looking for who was going to follow the lead Congressman Alcee Hastings, who passed earlier this year.
And by the way, the election for this is going to come up in January, right?
Right. The general election is set for January 11th, and it's broadly presumed that whoever wins the Democratic primary is probably going to walk away with it because it's such a heavily Democratic district.
Katie, this a lot of people running for this seat, and it's very close. The results still being counted, I believe. But I mean, how many people were running for this?
11. 11 Democrats were on the ballot vying for this. And it became this situation where, you know, it's kind of typical of how Democrats have been running in other races around Florida, less united than the Republicans, even in a Democratic district. And so you had two Broward County commissioners that had to resign their commission seats to try to run for Congress. You had other officials at the state level that had to resign to run for this. So it sort of created this massive domino effect of now we have to fill and plug other holes because people had really tried for this seat, but it was so crowded.
Yeah, an open congressional seat is a rare thing. So once that opened up, the pent up, backed up political ambition really came to the forefront. So it was a packed race.
And the other thing too, because and Katie, we were talking about it, laughing at the fact that, you know, last night before you went to bed, there was like 30 votes difference between the two, and now it was like down to 12, 9, something that close.
It's been changing a lot. That is how close this race is. Every single vote counts. People from the Wholeness campaign and Sheila Sherfless McCormick's campaign are watching every single vote that comes in, whether that's a military overseas ballot, whether that's, you know, a provisional ballot. There were a few of those. So this is not going to be settled right away. And yeah, when I went to bed last night, there were 31 votes separating the candidates in favor of Sheila. I woke up this morning. Dale was leading by 9. Now I believe he's leading by 12. That's going to keep changing as the day goes on. And it's one of those situations where it is absolutely headed for a recount.
Have they said anything about when they think they'll have the final results?
We don't know exactly yet, but the votes that are being counted now are the few outstanding vote-by-mail ballots.
Yep.
That came in. They just hadn't been counted yet. So that's where, you know, and this is very small margins.
Which is going to set off a recount, right?
It will, but I want to be very clear because people always wonder why some votes are still trickling in the day after Election Day, and it is. It's those last unvoted or uncounted vote-by-mail ballots. People are not continuing to vote after the polls have closed.
And what are the two campaigns that are in this race saying right now about what's happening? Or is everybody quiet?
It's basically cross your fingers, pray a little bit. You know, it's good. This particular race between last night and this morning has gone back and forth so many times. I talked with Sheila Sherfalis McCormick at her watch party yesterday. She told me when she got in the car to come to the watch party, she was down. When she arrived, just as she walked in, she went up. So she was, you know, emotionally kind of a wreck because she was expecting to, you know, lower. She was not expecting to be on top. And then she was, oh, now I'm on top. But it doesn't feel real because the margin is so small. So I think both candidates right now are really in that. Is this anxious. Real? Is this not real?
Yeah, and Broward County Commissioner Dale Holness is the other candidate that's so close in this. And he's sort of the hometown hero versus the more progressive Democrat in this race. And he's pretty anxious. And it was one of those, he wasn't sure what to say and when. He told me he did not think it would be this close.
Well, remind me again, too, if a race is close, then there's a machine recount before there's a hand recount, right?
Yes. So if the margin between the two candidates is under half of 1%, then it goes to an automatic machine recount by Florida law. If that margin is under 0.25%, it goes to a hand recount. And so I think both candidates, I mean, Commissioner Dale Holness was getting advice last night from several people to get your election lawyers ready.
And right. When this is decided, who is going to be the competition in the January general?
That is going to be Republican Jason Mariner. And what we know about him so far, he beat Greg Musselwhite by a clean margin. We sort of knew those results very early on in the night last night. He is for sort of a typical Trumpian or more far right agenda. And he's pretty popular, young guy, young kids, and he's interested. His platform is really focused on freedom from vaccine mandates and looking at, you know, securing the borders, a very DeSantis style campaign.
And of course, as mentioned, this is a very Democrat seat. Democrats have held that seat for some time. Again, talking about last night's election results, you can find more, by the way, just go to our website, WLRN.org, talking with Katie Swetalski-Munoz and Danny Rivero. I want to talk about some other races here in Miami that were on the radar. Danny, Mayor Francis Suarez won his reelection bid big. Who was running against him?
The short answer is not any very strong candidate in one way or the other. One candidate, Frank Pichel, was recently arrested in the Keys for allegedly impersonating a police officer. You had Myra Jolie, who's kind of a perennial conservative candidate who actually couldn't prove that she lived in the city of Miami. So a judge actually said it.
So did he even have a campaign? I mean, I saw some ads here and there, some signs, but not really a lot. I got some mailers. But did he have a campaign or was it just he figured, oh, I've got this in the bag?
I think it depends how you define campaign. There were certainly billboards, flyers, whatnot, but in the sense that there was debates, that there was real discussion between candidates. The fact is, you know, respectfully, none of the candidates that ran stood much of a chance in this election. That's just the reality of the situation, which is very rare for a major American city to not have, you know, the semblance of a competitive mayoral race. But that is what it was. Francis Suarez won as he won his first election by a massive margin.
A couple other races, too, to look at. City Commission Christine King wins District 5. Remind us a little bit about her.
Right. Christine King, born in Guyana, moved to Miami as a child. She worked for years in the county commission doing basically constituent services, which is essentially just helping residents solve issues that they're having with the local government. She worked in the Community Action Agency for years, which is a county agency that figures out where to direct resources for things like early childhood program funding that comes from the federal government, grants for small businesses and things like that. So she ran basically on the platform that she knows where the need is. She knows how to get it done. She's actually been campaigning for this seat for a long time. Current Commissioner Jeffrey Watson was appointed to the seat after Keon Hardiman, the former commissioner, won a seat at the county commission. And he jumped into the race at the last minute after pledging that he would not do that. He did not do very well. Christine King completely dominated
him, and it would be hard to miss her face if you're driving around the district. She was plastered everywhere.
One other one quickly. County Commissioner Joe Carollo won his reelection bid. I mean, he was in the news for the last couple of months, obviously, with the battle over firing the police chief, Art Acevedo. Obviously, that didn't hurt him. Maybe it helped him.
Yeah, I mean, Commissioner Carollo is kind of another perennial figure in City of Miami politics. He served twice as mayor. He's been around for about 40 years. It's very strong support in the Cuban-American community, especially the older Cuban-American community, who are the people that turned out in these off-year elections. So we saw exactly that happen. He won by a very large margin. The candidate that was endorsed by the Democratic Party, Quinn Smith, pulled about 20% of the vote. So it was something, but it was not nearly enough to really contest this or push it to a runoff.
Yeah, as you said. I mean, he's a very controversial figure, but we're in one of those off elections, and the turnout is very low. Again, you can check out all of the election results from last night. Just go to the website, WLRN.org. I want to turn over now to WLRN's Lance Dixon on some of the races also from yesterday. Lance, some big ones over in Miami Beach. Let's start with Mayor Dan Gelber. He won his reelection for his third and final term, but was it close?
So similarly to Danny, this one was not particularly close and was sort of a foregone conclusion, I think, in a lot of people's minds, people who were watching the race. So he got about 62% of the vote. The other candidates, the closest candidate after that was Jean Marie Echemendia. She got about 26% or so of the vote. So that was pretty straightforward for him. But I think the biggest thing on his agenda beyond re-election, obviously, was the 2 a.m. Rollback.
And voters said yes to the 2 a.m. last call for booze. So what happens now?
So it's important to note that was a straw ballot. So that wasn't a binding referendum or anything like that. So now, essentially, what it allows the mayor and the commission to do is, for folks who were supportive of it on the commission, they can say, okay, we've gotten this sort of vote of confidence from voters that we should proceed with this plan. So either at the next city commission meeting or in a subsequent city commission meeting, they'll talk about the plans for executing that.
It really lends popular legitimacy to the move that they want to do to ban alcohol sales after 2 a.m.
Does that tell us that Miami Beach voters want to change the city? Is that what this says?
Well, I mean, you know, in some ways I'd say yes, but it's hard to say, like with so many things in an off-year election like this. I mean, I think turnout in Miami Beach was about 22% of registered voters. So is that truly representative of everybody? And does all of the city want to see this happen? Hard to say, but based on how this shifted from 2017, when a similar question was proposed and was roundly defeated by voters, it seems like things are shifting in that direction.
Just wondering if there's no more partying in South Beach, where is it going to go? But some other races to look at, or some other things to look at. Voters went against incorporating Biscayne Gardens as the 35th municipality in Miami-Dade County. Was that close?
No, not particularly. So that was also another one that voters voted against that by more than about 60% of the registered voters, or the voters who participated in the election in that area. So we'll hold off for now on getting that 35th municipality in Miami-Dade County. But this is an incorporation effort that's been going on since about 2003, and I imagine that it won't stop here with this effort.
All right. I didn't put these in any particular order, so you know, I'm not saying one is more important than the other. But moving now to former County Commissioner Esteban Bobo, he won Hialeah's race as its new mayor. He's the first new mayor, I think, in a decade. All right. I mean, and by the way, he got a lot of support from the governor and from former President Trump.
Yeah. And that was a big thing, and got a lot of eyeballs on that race. And the race got pretty heated in the last, you know, few days of early voting and on Election Day, a lot of, you know, shouting between the candidates there. But I think that definitely put it on people's radar, definitely was a big assist to him. And, you know, for what it's worth, even without that endorsement, he's former county commissioner, former mayoral candidate for Miami-Dade County. So he had a lot of name recognition going into it, even without that boost of confidence from the former president.
When's the last time I saw a mayor's race with a presidential, you know, seal? Hey, I'm with you.
It's not particularly common, but it's not unheard of. I mean, there are some, even if it's not the president necessarily, but there are a lot of instances where former elected officials at a higher level than the local politics will chime in and give their endorsements.
And just to chime in for a second, Hialeah is a massive city.
Oh, it's, one of the biggest in the state. Yeah.
Yeah, it's bigger than Fort Lauderdale. I think a lot of people just forget that. It's very strategically important for the Republican Party in general to have a strong foothold in Hialeah, because the turnout in the 2020 election for President Trump was astronomical. You know, that is actually probably the stronghold for Republicans here in Miami-Dade County.
Very good point. Didn't forget about that. That's very true. Again, you can check out all the results from last night's elections. Just go to our website, WLRN.org. Let me turn now to the Miami Herald's local government reporter, Samantha Gross, and we look at a couple of other races. Samantha, first, let's start with Sunny Isles Beach. There were two mayoral candidates. There's a runoff election now, right?
Correct. There were actually four candidates that were running to replace Bud Scholl, who stepped down from mayor of Sunny Isles Beach in August. The top two vote getters did not reach that 50% threshold. So Commissioner Dana Goldman and the kind of sitting mayor, Laura Svetchin, are going to be running in a runoff election on November 16th.
And what should the voters know about this runoff?
Yeah, so it'll be happening on the 16th. It's been a little bit of a contentious race. The two have kind of gone back and forth. There were some texts that had come out in May where they were kind of texting negative messaging about one another. They're, you know, interesting candidates. Laura Svetchin was first elected to the commission in 2016 and was reelected again in 2020. And Dana Goldman, who's a real estate attorney, filled a vacancy on the commission in 2014 and has been winning her re-elections ever since. So the two of them have a history on the commission there in Sunny Isles Beach, and voters will get another shot at, voting for their next mayor in a couple weeks.
All right, and that's in a couple of weeks. In Homestead, the mayor gets a second term.
Yes, just by a hair. It was a very close race in Homestead last night. But the incumbent mayor or the incumbent candidate, Mayor Steve Lossner, secured a second 2-year term. So he'll get another couple years to, you know, make his mark in Homestead, which, yep, a city where his family's been around for more than 100 years.
When you say close, how close?
It was very close. It came down to 68 votes about. That's unofficial results, but it seems like a tiny margin, but it was still a larger than 0.5%. So not close enough for a recount, but certainly, you know, down to the wire there in Homestead.
That's the thing you love about Florida politics. By the way, what was it for him? What was the big issue in Homestead?
Yeah, I mean, I think for him and for everyone running and also for voters, I mean, everyone wants to bring balance to development. It's a city that's growing really fast. He told me last night that he also hopes to kind of get back to some of his priorities that he was working on before COVID, which included kind of cleaning up the city code, working on some road infrastructure, and figuring out what to do with the old City Hall building, which is in the downtown historic district there in Homestead. So I think he's hoping to get some of those things ticked off that got interrupted in the pandemic.
Yeah, no doubt. Anybody who's lived here long enough, if you remember Homestead, I remember Homestead going back to Hurricane Andrew, very different place, growing extremely fast. Miami Herald's local government reporter, Samantha Gross, thank you so much. All of our election results, by the way, on our website, WLRN.org. I want to thank Lance Dixon, Danny Rivero, Katie Swatowski-Munoz. Really appreciate the time.
Sure thing.
Thanks, Louis.
All right.
Thank you.
Coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to talk to a longtime Key West resident about a new exhibit that shows a very different side of the city. But first, is it possible that high school basketball in Miami-Dade may be canceled because there are not enough referees? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. High school basketball in Miami-Dade, which is supposed to start next week, could be in danger of being disrupted. And it's not because of COVID. There may not be enough referees to officiate the games. In Miami-Dade, referees are part of the GMAC, the Greater Miami Athletic Conference, and that's run by the school district. Now, there are 26 official associations around the state, and most of them are independent. Well, now Miami wants to be independent, too. Miami officials want to separate from the GMAC and become their own independent group, and they applied for it with the state, which is the Florida High School Athletic Association. But the state hasn't granted it yet. So what happens now? Well, joining me is Craig Clay. He's the vice president of Miami's Basketball Official Association. Craig, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Lewis, for having me.
So trying to explain how this works, and I had to learn. I didn't realize. I think we take for granted, you go to a high school game, your kids are playing, they're just referees, and maybe people don't realize where the referees come from. But I wondered, let's start with this. Why do Miami referees want to self-govern and be their own independent group and separate from the school district?
Well, Lewis, as you mentioned, 26 officials associations throughout the state of Florida, and overwhelmingly 95% of them are self-governed. We believe that by self-governing ourselves, that we would be able to provide tremendous benefits to the current officials and to new officials. You know, one of the things that happens is that there is a shortage across the country of officials. And, you know, it is very cost prohibitive for a new official to get started. You know, we want to help that. And we believe by self-governing fees that are collected on our behalf, making sure that those fees are used on the officials is what we want to do.
And you had a meeting with the school district yesterday, correct?
We did.
Can you tell me anything about it?
Well, we believe the meeting was productive. There were members of our executive board present, along with some members of the GMAC. We laid out, Lewis, for them exactly the things that I'm telling you, and hopefully the outcome will be positive. We are supposed to reconvene at some point later this week or early next week, and hopefully we'll be able to move forward.
So let's understand again how this works. The referees are part of the GMAC. You pay fees, right, to be part of this?
Yes, we do.
And how much typically does a referee, to be a referee, what does it cost?
Well, you're looking at potentially $500 or $600 before you even hit the floor. There's a fee that's paid to the FHSAA, the Florida High School Athletic Association. There is a fee paid to the Greater Miami Athletic Conference. There's a fee for fingerprinting. There are fees to receive training. Certainly, those officials do not just go out and start refereeing without training. And then, of course, there are uniforms and things of that nature that have to be purchased in order for the official to be ready to officiate a high school basketball game.
And those fees, who's collecting them, and where does that money go?
Those fees are currently collected by the GMAC. And it is unclear where those fees are going. But what I can tell you is that they are not going to support the referees currently.
How do referees get paid?
Referees in Miami-Dade County are paid per game. And that's generally the way it works in all high school sports. They're paid per game. They function as independent contractors. That's it.
So what would be the benefits of being self-governed, starting your own, as you said, because most associations in the state, I think it's 23 of the 26, are independent, self-governed. What would be the benefits of being self-governed?
Well, you know, right off the bat, Lewis, those fees that I'm talking about, if there are fees that would be collected, and certainly there would be some fees, those fees, though, would go directly to support the officials. I mentioned the cost it takes to begin officiating. One of the things that we have talked about as an executive board is providing a starter package for officials at the beginning of the season to defray many of those costs. We want to provide the training classes at no cost to our officials, both during preseason and in the summer. We also do training camps. You know, we want to provide scholarships to officials who want to pursue higher levels of officiating. Many of our officials, including myself, officiate at the college level, and that requires a higher level of training. Our association has produced three current NBA officials from this association, Dedrick Taylor, John and Jason Goble. both of those gentlemen officiated with us at the high school level years before they became NBA officials. We have officials in our group who have the talent to do that. And we want to provide opportunities for them to do it and not make it cost prohibitive for them.
To get this recognition, you need the state, right? The FHSAA, that again, the Florida High School Athletic Association, to recognize. And they have a process for you to go through. And you were telling me that you went through this process. There's like five steps you got to go through. And then is it that they have to consider it, or it's a given? If you do the if you follow the process, okay, they'll give it to you.
Well, they have to make the determination. We submitted our request for sanctioning back in May of 2021. So it's not a new thing. We have been talking about this for quite some time. And there are actually six steps that they lay out to be a new officials association. One is you have to certainly properly complete and submit an application to the FHSAA. We did that. That, again, was done on May 27th. You have to have a unique name that is not already used by another officials association. We did that. We created the Miami-Dade Basketball Officials Association. You have to submit to them an IRS letter showing that it is a legitimate organization with a taxpayer ID number. We did that. You have to provide a list of names of individual officials who would be prospective members. We went above and beyond that, Lewis, because what we did is we collected signatures, actual signatures of officials who said that they would join the Miami-Dade Basketball Officials Association. And then there's another step where the FHSAA has to, those officials who were listed have to register with the state. The state has not allowed that to happen because they have not sanctioned the organization. There's no way that those officials can go in and register with them if they have not sanctioned the organization. And then one last step is the FHSAA says that you must successfully demonstrate in writing that there is a need for sanction for a new association. And that is where a lot of the discourse is coming from, because this is not a new association. As you mentioned early on, these are the same officials who are currently officiating for the GMAC and now wanting to officiate under a new umbrella, a separate independent umbrella, the Miami-Dade Basketball Officials Association.
Have you, Craig, have you heard from anybody from the state and as to why it's taken this long?
Well, we heard from them about a month after our application was submitted. What they did is they asked the schools, do they believe that there is a need for a new association? And again, the question is a little bit misleading, and the question was asked to the schools without any context. The schools were not aware that there was a sanctioning application for the new association. They were asked this question. It's a one-line question. And most of them said no, because they did not understand what it was they were being asked. On that sole reason, the FHSAA said that they would be denying the sanctioning. So, you know, at this point, what we have asked is that the GMAC support our sanctioning application to the state.
Again, I'm talking with Craig Clay. He's the vice president of Miami's Basketball Officials Association. And as we're discussing, this is a group that is linked to the school district, but they want to be self-governed. They want to be independent, like most of the other official associations that exist in the state. And again, these are the associations that govern referees for high school events. And so they've gone through the process, as he's described, and still battling it out with the state as to whether or not they can get that sanction, that they can be sanctioned and self-govern themselves. So, Craig, of course, the story that came out in the Herald was, you know, how is this going to affect the upcoming high school basketball season? Again, as you said, the referees work as contractors, they're hired by the schools. Is there a possibility when high school basketball starts next week that there are no referees?
One, there are about 140 referees who have previously officiated in Miami-Dade County. Only, to our knowledge, less than 10 of those have registered with the GMAC. So the officials are very serious about what it is that they want. They understand the benefits of being their separate independent organization. And, you know, we have spoken to our membership. Our membership, we have encouraged them to stay physically ready to officiate, and certainly mentally ready to officiate when the time comes.
And I'm wondering, like, I mean, the coaches, the schools, and again, you met with the school district, as much as you can tell me, do they support you? Do they support the referees being able to form their own group and get moving forward?
Well, Lewis, we will know more by the end of the week. They have made a commitment to get back to us by the end of the week, no later than early next week, as to whether or not they will support.
When it comes to a high school basketball game, just so we understand, how many referees do you have to have? And, you know, we have to point out, you can't just pluck anybody from, the stands to referee a game. It's got to be somebody who's trained.
That's correct. So, Lewis, there are probably approximately 90 public and private schools that field basketball teams in Miami-Dade County. Most of those games in Miami-Dade County have two officials, depending on the level and the competitiveness of the contest, sometimes there will be three. So you can imagine that if you had the majority of those schools playing a game on any given night, you're going to need those 140 men and women who have registered before. You're going to need them.
I wonder, I mean, have you heard from coaches or parents who are concerned, like, hey, my kid's going to play, and this isn't just about having the ability to play a game, because you got a lot of kids who this is to play because they may be working towards scholarships, so they have to have basketball. Have you been hearing from anybody about their any concerns for this upcoming season?
Oh yes, we've heard from coaches. Many of us have officiated for many, many years, so we've developed relationships with coaches, with athletic directors. We've heard from them, and they are concerned. And when we have had the opportunity to explain to them what exactly it is that we are looking for, many of them understand it. Many of them support it. Now it's just a matter of us doing it officially and getting moving forward with the season.
So again, as you had mentioned, you hope by the end of this week you'll hear back from the school district, the Miami-Dade School District, as to whether or not they're supporting you on this. But it comes down to, again, the state, the FHSAA, and whether or not they're going to agree. How long might it take for them to say, okay, you got it, you got your group, go for it?
We don't believe that it'll take long, Lewis. As I mentioned, we have provided all of the information that is consistent with the request for a new sanctioning or additional sanctioning. All of that information has been provided. It would now simply be a matter of cleaning up that first question that they asked that was misleading and with no context. And I think once that happens, that should be able to be done very quickly. And we can move on and have a very, very productive season.
Because, again, the girls' basketball season starts, I believe, November 8th, and the boys' basketball season is like a week later, the 15th, 14th, or 15th. So it's literally, it's around the corner. So hopefully everything gets worked out, because those kids have to get out there on the court and play. Craig Clay, Vice President of Miami's Basketball Official Association. Fascinating story. One we'll keep an ear out for. Craig, thank you for the insight. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Lewis, and you have a great day.
And by the way, if you're a parent and you've got your kids are playing basketball in Miami-Dade this season, what's your concern? You know, what have you been hearing? And, you know, what's the alternative? If there are no referees, what are your kids going to do? You know what? Text us. Join the Sundial Text Club at 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. We'd love to hear from you and your thoughts on this. And again, we'll keep an eye out for what's going to happen with the story. Well, still to come, an exhibit in Key West shows us a very different Key West. Think Cheap Rent, LSD, and Tennessee Williams. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so what do you think about when you hear the word Key West? What comes to mind? Well, I'm going to tell you about a story. There was a time when Key West was nothing like what you know of it today. No tourists. It was very different. Think from the 60s through the 80s. This was an era where you had cheap rent, drug smuggling, you had phone booths. Remember those things? Well, a local named Rita Troxell collected first-person stories from the people who lived in Key West during that time, and she put it together in a book titled Home at the End of the World. There's an exhibit at the studios of Key West showcasing the stories and the photos of that era, and it's going to be open to the public starting tomorrow. So joining me now is Rita to talk about some of these stories. Rita, great to have you.
Louis, thank you so much.
And by the way, I just want to mention, if anybody was living in Key West during that era, during the 60s and 80s, through the 80s, you could share it. Just text us 786-677-0767 or find us on social media, WLRN Sundial. Tell us one quirky story. I'd love to hear one of those quirky stories. Rita, you write about the first time you set foot on Key West back in 1972. Sorry, don't mean to call you out on age there. And you were on a mission to start a theater. But tell me, when you first arrived in Key West, well, like, what's the first thing that jumped out at you?
Well, when we arrived, we went to Little Duck Key. And let me just say that back then, I thought when you left Miami and you went across a bridge, there would be Key West.
Nope.
Nope, it doesn't work that way. So we mostly camped out at Little Duck Key, me and a gang of theater people, I being the only woman in the group. And we went into Key West one day, but we arrived in Key West tripping on Sandoz LSD 25. So my first impression of Key West was very interesting. It was as if you turned on the bright lights in a room. It was magical. I remember thinking there are black cats everywhere, which must mean this was some kind of witchy pirate town. We wandered the streets. The beauty of the tropics, I had never been anywhere tropical in my life. So this was an amazing, amazing thing for me.
And I can only imagine that being on LSD, it probably was extra trippy. What was it about, but tell me, what was it about Key West that made you want to come back?
It was a very exciting place. It was open to creativity. There didn't seem to be any judgment. You know, we found one friend hanging out with a bunch of shrimpers at the midget bar, and we were hardly a group of shrimpers. You know, we were hippies from college. It was just a very accepting place that you could feel the creativity.
All right. So you did start your theater.
We did start our theater. Yes, we did. The theater started in, the opening was 1976. And that was with these two gentlemen, Jimmy Russell and Peter Pell, who owned Key West Handprint Fabrics. They became our sponsors, and they had introduced us to Tennessee Williams. And we wanted to do Suddenly Last Summer as our first play. So they made the connections, and Tennessee started coming to our rehearsals, which was amazing to us. I mean, we were 25 years old. And you always knew when Tennessee was in the audience because he laughed longer and louder than anyone. And as I've said before, it's to people, it's not that we were so great. It's more that he was just tickled with his own writing as much as the first time he'd written it. So he was very supportive. He changed the ending of Suddenly Last Summer for us to make it more obvious that the lobotomy was probably going to happen.
and invited us to his house many times. You know, and it was an amazing experience. I mean, we were in the New York Times the next morning, which was just shocking to us.
You know, I think about it. I mean, it's again, Key West, the Keys were so different back then. And so you think about, like, yeah, you could have a theater today and you got a big audience, a lot of people who want that. I mean, did you have that kind of, because it was Tennessee Williams, I'd imagine just a lot of people wanted to see him. But I mean, did you have that same crowd back then that you have today that would, you know, were totally into the arts and into theater?
We actually did. I mean, there was a big artistic community. The literary community was already here. A lot of artists were moving in. And the local community embraced us as well. I mean, for the opening, people flew in from New York and Los Angeles. So we had that. But it was supportive otherwise. And we were just determined that we were going to do cutting edge plays, and we didn't care about money, and we were just going to do what we wanted to do. And much of the time we did, and shows were full. Our audience was full.
Now you got to tell me about the story on an opening night. The landlord cut off the lights in the middle of a show. What?
Yes. Charlie Ramos was our landlord and a big, big Key West name. And he had decided that we hadn't paid the rent, I believe. And so in the middle of the show, he just, the lights went out. But in Key West back then, lights went out often. It was not unusual for the electricity to go. So we all sat there in the dark, the audience and those of us on stage, and sat there until my late husband, Roddy, stood up and said, "Look, why doesn't everybody go over to Sloppy Joe's? We'll take care of the bill for your drinks and we'll figure out the problem." So everyone got up and went, of course. And we went back to the, you know, electric box, and it was padlocked. So, you know, we got clippers and we opened it. And turn the electricity back on.
Oh, you know, it's, I mean, and all the stories like this is what you have in this book, is all these quirky stories, which really, I mean, when you read them, as I'm going through them, I'm like, of course this would happen in Key West. But where did the idea come to collect all these stories?
Oh, gosh. Well, there was a group of us friends that every time we would have a dinner party or, you know, any other gathering, we would eventually go back to stories of back in the day. And we would argue about whose version of the story was correct. And I thought, you know, we really have to get this down because we're not getting any younger. People at that point, we had lost many people to AIDS. And that's it. You know, I need to collect these stories. So I started doing that, and it started off very, very slowly. It was before social media. There was no easy way to contact people. Many people had already moved. So it was word of mouth, and by drips and drabs, some stories came into my mailbox, you know, from somebody local who just stuffed it into the mailbox. And then when I spoke to my friend Jamie Alcroft, who was an editor on the book and part of the comedy team, Mac and Jamie, I asked him for a story, and he said, "Why don't you call this other friend of ours, Dee Dee? She has a blog." So I did that, and she put the word out that I was collecting the stories and my contact information if anybody wanted to contribute, which they did. And
then your mailbox got packed.
And then my mailbox and my email, and it spread by word of mouth. And so in this book, there are 71 stories by 52 different people. So it worked.
I'm talking with Rita Troxell. She curated a book. It's called Home at the End of the World. And again, as she mentioned, it's a collection of stories from the people who lived in Key West from the 60s through the 80s. And by the way, there's a new exhibit, as I mentioned, at the studios of Key West, showcasing these stories and a lot of photos throughout that time. And it's going to be open to the public starting tomorrow. And you can get more information on our social media about the book, about the exhibit at WLRN Sundial. One of the contributors is artist John Martini, and he recalled a time when rent was cheap. Gosh, I remember those times. And when there were a lot of phone booths on Key West, In his story, A Spiritual Center is the name of the story, he writes about being evicted from his sculpture studio. What do these stories tell us about Key West identity at the time? What jumps out at you?
From John's story?
Especially his, yeah.
Well, we had created a community here. I mean, we were kind of the artists, the gypsies. We were the, you know, invaders onto Key West from the people who had already been living here. But it was a very quiet community, and there was this empty space on the Navy base that had been the administration building. And the artists were able to rent rooms in that building very inexpensively, which was what was needed for a starting artist, you know, in their early 20s, not really recognized yet. And it was a wonderful thing for everyone that was there. There were sculptors and painters and woodworkers and all sorts of people. And then when the Truman Annex was sold, you know, well, what some people thought was that they would be able to stay there, because what a great thing to have this space on the island. And no, they were all evicted. And, you know, Truman Annex, as it is today, was built. Luckily, the studios of Key West in modern times has picked up that mantle and created a space for artists. You know, it's a good thing that we have studios, but I know the artists struggled then to go find space in order to make their work.
Yeah. I did want to ask you about, you wrote about the story, The Barefoot Dentist. Please explain.
Oh, the Barefoot Dentist. I only minorly mentioned The Barefoot Dentist. I asked him for a story. I just want you to know.
Okay.
But that happens to be my husband. And Fred Troxell, and he is a dentist on Big Pine Key, and he has started coming down here in 1968, mostly to Big Pine. But he went barefoot all the time, and he still is barefoot in the office. And so you know, he got the nickname the Barefoot Dentist.
I don't think of dentist and barefoot at the same time, but. You know what? Again, Key West, I get it. I totally get it. You know,
and he would tell you that when you work, you should be comfortable. And if you're not comfortable, that's not good.
Wow.
So,
wow. Okay. All right. Good excuse. I like that. You know, Rita, what do you hope people take away from the book and the exhibit?
Well, the exhibition, I'll just explain briefly. The exhibition is a collection of photographs from myself, my collection, and other professional photographers, Lawson Little, Joanne Savio, Tom Corcoran, to name just a few. Many, many of the photos that were contributed did not make it into the book because there just wasn't enough room or money. And so the exhibition, we were able, Lynn Bentley Kemp spent numerous hours, you know, touching up these 45-year-old photos that needed serious help. And so many, many of the photos that are in the book or in the exhibition, as well as many photos that didn't make it into the book. And, you know, I hope that people take away that the history of our time here, which was very special before things changed, before things became more commercial. And it was a sweet, crazy, beautiful life we had. Not that I regret still being here. I love being here. But it was a very different, very simpler time.
I think about, you know, the times I've been to Key West, and I'd never been down there in that era. And so I just think about how quirky it is now. And I say that lovingly. I think it's a beautiful place. But I read through your stories and I'm just like, oh my goodness, that must have been a fun time. I'm going to say this, one of my favorite stories, Tennessee Williams. Great story about a very fancy dinner party. Again, acid is involved and Tennessee Williams at the dinner table. And I'll just leave it at that. Check out the book. It really is a lot of fun. Rita Troxell, again, the new exhibit is at the studios of Key West. And the book is at home. It's Home at the End of the World. It's a really fun read. Rita, thank you so, so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, if you lived in Key West during that era, share with us a quirky story, too. You can email at sundial@wlrnnews.org or find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, November 3rd. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk with Miami Beach's mayor, Dan Gelber. Again, he won his third term yesterday, and he got the referendum on the 2 a.m. last call. So what are his plans for the city now in his final term? Also, did you know money from the Confederate South featured hidden images of enslaved people? African-American artist John W. Jones recreated these paintings to provide a sense of dignity for the enslaved and shed a new light on the relationship between slavery and America's economic power. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. It's, by the way, that's a new exhibit in Broward showcasing the paintings. We're going to talk about that tomorrow on the show. Find us again on the website WLRN.org/sundial or again on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.